Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jay Gunkelman. He is the man who has read over 500,000 brain scans. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and viewers just like you. And a special thanks to our gold and silver supporters. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop December 10th and 11th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend: online or in person with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. And if you sign up now, you can join Dr. Robert Thatcher at his house for a pre-course get-together December 9th. It's going to be a blast. What a better way to enjoy winter by being in Madeira Beach, Florida, and earning up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. MindMedia.com. Get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from MindMedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit MindMedia.com now. What is a savant? What's going on with the brain? Is that something we could talk about?
Savant ends up having such a gigantic comorbidity with Asperger's traits. You've locked onto a topic in kind of an obsessive way, and your blinders have you focused in on that and that alone. Now, with that kind of a focus, you can learn a tremendous amount about a given subject. Look at an 8-year-old knowing about dinosaurs. I mean, they'll know more about dinosaurs than I've ever learned about dinosaurs. But then I wasn't into them. I was a science and technology, the same thing, you know.
So savant and Asperger's, I mean, for the general population.
There's a huge comorbidity. Comorbidity. You know, and somebody who's a savant very often is so focused on their topic that they don't have traditional social skill sets. And they're good at one thing and one thing only. You remember the movie Rain Man.
Obviously. Yeah.
There's super skill set for somebody, but he's just totally non-functional. It's hard to get him to pass even in a normal setting as somebody who's even close to functional. There are savants who are, kind of halfway passing as normal, but my old business partner referred to me as one, a savant of EEG, because he didn't know anything. He couldn't find anything that I didn't actually already kind of know about EEG. But I've been fascinated with it since I was young, and very much like a kid who's so focused on dinosaurs, you can end up picking up a tremendous amount of information, and if that's what you're interested in, you can build a gigantic network of data that ends up having a structure to it. So when you learn something new, it's one little piece put into a structure you already have. So learning more things in an area you know well, the additional things are easy because you actually have the structure to, the tree to hang them on, basically. And, there's a lot of factoid ornaments to hang on any tree in any subject.
Well, Jay, you brought up Rain Man, and that was from the book Awakenings, I believe. Dr. Malcolm Sayer, and the guy in the movie, Robert De Niro, who did a great job, he was supposed to be Leonard. And they were messing around with L-DOPA. Do you remember anything about what was going on back then?
Actually, L-DOPA is able to wake people up out of a frozen state. If you look up online, frozen people, you're going to find that in the 70s in the Bay Area, there was a bad batch of MDMA, ecstasy that was made. And people used it at a rave and they had a great time. And when they woke up the next morning, they were frozen. They could not move. They had an advanced Parkinsonism induced by the medication. And they were frozen. And they basically weren't it was like the worst advanced Parkinsonism you can find. And you can't initiate, you're basically frozen. And there were a few of them, not many, but there were a few of them that were taken over to Europe, and they had dopamine implants, fetal tissue implants, dopamine from a fetus tissue implanted in, and they unfroze. The others received dopamine compounds here in the United States, which is, that's essentially the way you treat Parkinson's disease is dopamine-related supplementation. And it works for a while, but it's not functional long term. The earlier you take it, the sooner it becomes ineffective. And so there's a lot of Parkinson's patients that kind of wait and wait and wait in order to start their dopamine therapy. But at this point, for advanced PD in the US, there's a solution. I had a friend in the little tiny town of Crockett, California, in 2000, 3,200 people. It's a itty bitty burg. And so, if somebody's in town, you're going to see them, you're going to know them. And, I knew him as a runner, and he would run from Crockett to Port Costa and back in the mornings, and you'd see him running around town, all, peppy and running. And, a couple of years later, I saw him, and he was really having a great deal of trouble shuffling down the sidewalk. And I stopped and I chatted with him a little bit, and he said, "You've been running, and now you're walking, but not well. You're shuffling. What's going on?" And he said, "Oh, I've got Parkinson's disease, and I'm thinking about having a deep brain stimulator put in." And I told him that's a really, really good idea for you at the stage that you're at. The deep
What
brain
is that?
stimulator, what's that?
What is a deep brain stimulator?
It's a device that's got the ability to create a stimulation within the brain, and it's usually put into the subthalamic nucleus. And that's part of the motor regulatory loop, and it provides an electrical stimulation, and that stops tremors. So your pill rolly hand tremor, the Parkinson's have what they call a pill roll hand tremor, and the bob of the head, all of that stops, and it stops quickly. You turn on the stimulator. It's not like, well, 2 days from now you'll have some effect. It'll get better over the next month. No, it's like clicko, the tremor goes, stops. And if you turn it off, the tremor returns. Now, deep brain stimulators are used to treat advanced Parkinsonism, and it's quite effective. It's a relatively straightforward surgical implant, stereotactic implant. What they stimulate has changed over the years. Initially, they had a DC stimulation, basically just a direct current. And the Dirk de Ritter, MD, PhD neurosurgeon, invented pulse mode stimulation up at the 600 hertz range. So it actually mimics spike trains of that neurons would be making. And when they implant that, they basically can turn on the stimulator and turn off your tremor. So the frozen postures, which are advanced Parkinsonism, and tremors end up being able to be effectively treated. Now, you don't have to take exogenous dopamine, which does have some side effects. I mean, dopamine operates on your pleasure center, and there's all sorts of potential side effects from that. But even setting all that aside, if you're frozen in your postures and you're tremulous, it's a debilitating circumstance. People walk around and away from people that look that advanced in Parkinsonism. It's off-putting. Now, it's unfortunate because actual Parkinsonism, your brain is still relatively intact. Now, in advanced states, there's some circuitry, pardon me, some circuitry that's lost for function, so you do degrade. But initially, the appearance of tremor and bobbing of head and everything, you're still conversational. Now, not everybody ends up having Parkinson's disease. You can have tremors and have other disturbances that are actually happening. The comedian who ended up having Lewy body, and Robin Williams, his they thought it was Parkinsonism at first because they look the same. The big difference is that Lewy body cycles a bit. So you get worse and then you get better. But when you're worse, you actually have hallucinations. I mean, full-blown hallucinations. I could see Pete Jansen standing in front of me when you're not even close, So, and it's not like it's a distortion of what I'm seeing. It's like full-blown freaking hallucinations. And, it's a different entity. But they're misdiagnosed quite often. And since you get better again and you realize I'm going to get worse again, and when you cycle a couple of times and you realize you're about to go back down into the depth of pathology, it's not uncommon in Lewy body for people to actually have a suicidal ideation that they'll act on. They just don't want to end up into the depths of the experience of it again. And it's everybody's choice. I mean, there are locations that allow you to do suicide. In California, there's laws around that as well. One that I've taken advantage of is the POLST EMT DNR. Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Technology, EMT, Emergency Medical Tech, do not resuscitate. You might have a do not resuscitate order at a hospital so that they don't do something extraordinary to try to keep you around after you've gone down bad. But that DNR doesn't stop an EMT from resuscitating you out on the street if you go down. So if you have a POLST EMT DNR, they can't touch you. There's a doctor order telling them that they have to leave you alone. And if you go to another state, that order isn't really valid. The doctor who signed it might not be licensed in that state, and the EMT in another state may end up having to do what they're mandated to do, which is ignore all that kind of stuff and actually do resuscitation.
Now,
But
Jay,
then I can't
Parkinson.
travel anyway, so I'll be here in California. That is not I don't have to worry about where I am. When I go down, all they can do is shoo the flies away. So
I'll see you soon enough. So,
yeah,
Jay, the Parkinson's, that takes a while, right? And we're talking about implants, and Elon Musk is getting all the headlines, and I know it's a totally different thing, but if it takes that long, because if you're shuffling your feet, that means you've had it for a while, right?
in fact, before you have your first symptom, about 75% of the cells in the substantia nigra are already toast. There's a huge redundancy, and by the time you're symptomatic, it's kind of almost too late to really fully save that nuclear body. You're going to have movement disorders of some sort unless there's a major intervention. Dopamine kind of puts you a couple percent back in play, so you're not symptomatic for a bit. But the stimulator is really the only thing that's going to give you a relatively longer term improvement. Not all stimulators last all that well. The brain area that they're stimulating sometimes has atrophy, so the where they're implanted ends up not really being as fully functional as they used to be. It's not unusual for implants to have multiple electrodes. It looks like a little paddle with maybe a dozen little electrode dots on it. And once it's implanted, they have to figure out which pair of dots need to be turned on in order to have it optimally functional. And if it becomes less functional, they'll usually try to program a different set of dots to see if they can recover the functionality that has been lost. And the old DC stim implants actually electrolyze the cortex in the area. So if you took the implants out, you could see exactly where they were. And it kind of like having an imprint of something that you press something into the sand and now you see what it was that was implanted or imprinted. So, but the pulse stimulation doesn't have that. And the batteries last a lot longer if you're not doing constant DC current or pulses of DC. The brief spiking ends up having a longer battery life.
So Jane, ideal situation, there is no ideal situation with Parkinson's, but let's just say you do your DNA, and I know a 23andMe, from what I saw, it says, hey, you have this percentage likelihood of getting it. It's not 100%, but I mean, it gives you a clue.
Yeah.
And it says, hey, you know, you better watch out for it. Well, if you better watch out for it and somebody knows that, what should they do? Like, do you get an EEG and a baseline each year? Like, what advice would you look?
if you start to see subtle tremor or difficulty initiating movements, it's time to be evaluated for it. And go into a neurologist at that point for a full eval. But I have to say, genetic testing gives you the genetic marker that corresponds with people that have it, but not everybody has their genes expressed. You can have the Alzheimer's gene and not get it. You can have a breast cancer gene and not get it. You have lots of genes and they don't express. So, it's when you get genetic testing, they have a genetic counselor that meets with you, and the counselor basically kind of puts a little dampening on your angst over what you see in your genetic testing. Again, not everything ends up coming to fruition.
Right.
Luckily.
What do you see in the brain? Like, what areas are dysregulated when you're just like, you start feeling the symptoms, and because I thought you said that once you get the symptoms, it's too late. I'm just trying to see if there's anything in between. Like, what are you going to see in the brain map?
Well, once you got symptoms, you're not going to be fully recovered unless you have an intervention.
Okay.
And the intervention may be pharma. It might be implant. Again, they usually wait for the implants until you're fairly advanced. They don't do that as the first blush. You'll get quite a few years out of pharma, taking L-DOPA and L-DOPA dopamine related compounds. And when that starts to not work, your alternative is basically to get an implant. Now, my friend in Little Crockett ended up getting the implant, and I then see him jogging through town again, and not a shuffly jog. I mean, he was, fully mobile again. And boy, was he ecstatic. He was so worried about the implant thing. Brain surgery isn't, if somebody says they're going to open your head up and put something in, you got to wonder, gee, who's going to be at the other end of that surgery? Am I going to be me? What's the outcome? What if, I mean, not every anesthesia goes well. What if I come out of it with brain fog or a personality change? For some of us, a personality change wouldn't be such a bad deal, I mean, just swap it out for a better one somehow. But when you hear personality change as a symptom, it's not that people got better. Nobody comes in complaining, Uncle John got nice, It's, Grandpa got grumpy and angry and had a personality change. It's never for the better. So, PD, Parkinson's, is something you can actually see in the EEG. Rodolfo Linus, a very famous researcher, identified that there's a cross-frequency coupling, that alpha in the area slows down to about 6 cycles a second, which is outside the traditional alpha band. It slows into the theta frequency band, but it's slowed alpha, not theta. And the International Federation tells you if you see something in the theta band, you have to identify whether it's limbically generated theta or thalamocortically slowed alpha that happens to be in that band. And for a dysrhythmia, it's slowed alpha. And when alpha slows to that point, what you end up having is areas adjacent to it end up invading. The brain doesn't want a spot that doesn't have a function. So what's happened is when the alpha slows to about 6, the lateral inhibition that keeps the function in that spot being the function in that spot, when you lose that function, the adjacent area will invade. Lateral inhibition is gone, so the lateral areas invade. And what happens in the EEG is that gamma turns on like a donut surrounding the spot that's missing, and it invades. The donut will squeeze in until it occupies that spot. It's neuroplasticity gone awry. And what you end up seeing is the 6 and the gamma end up being cross-frequency coupled. And that's seen in the bispectrum. Again, cross-frequency coupling, you can't just look at a spectral peak. You have to have multiple peaks. And you look at it with software that identifies that those peaks aren't independent, they're actually linked. And the gamma isn't pulsed. It's not brief bursts of gamma, which is healthy. It's persistent gamma, which is always pathological. Persistent gamma is seen in an epileptic focus. It's seen in Parkinson's disease. It's seen in tinnitus. It's seen in some forms of chronic pain. It's seen in some forms of reward deficiency syndrome, like depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, addiction. And the spot in the brain differs, but it's the same foundational process. Thalamocortical dysrhythmia. Again, initially, Rodolfo Linus identified it. Dirk De Ridder, MD, PhD, and neurosurgeon, Belgium and New Zealand labs. He's really quite well known worldwide. End up finding it in tinnitus. And he had a tinnitus database of over 1,000 people. And that you could use that database to kind of characterize what tinnitus looked like. So we had the ability of a machine learning algorithm to, when you come in and they record your brain, it would tell you whether your brain looked like tinnitus or not. And he had a patient come in, and he had Parkinson's disease, and the algorithm said tinnitus. And Dirk goes, well, that's not right. This is tinnitus, not Parkinson's disease. And upon further examination, the thalamocortical dysrhythmia, the same kind of a problem in a different neural network was all it was. So Rodolfo Linus's identification of Parkinson's disease or movement disorders in the motor premotor area that regulates movement was one thalamocortical dysrhythmia. But if it happens in the auditory cortex, it's tinnitus. And literally, you'll have spots that carry different frequency information invading. So you have phantom sound. If you lose a limb, you can have phantom pain. And again, it's a lack of an input to the cortical area, the alpha for the hand area that's missing, basically will not have an input. It will slow down dramatically to about 6 hertz. And at that point, the face area, you touch the face and you feel it as pain in your hand.
Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop December 10th and 11th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. And if you sign up now, you can join Dr. Robert Thatcher at his house for a pre-course get-together December 9th. It's going to be a blast. What a better way to enjoy winter by being in Madeira Beach, Florida, and earning up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops.
It's misplaced localization. And the same cortical plasticity for tinnitus, pain, movement disorders, and reward deficiency. Just a different network. Dirk De Ridder published that in Nature 3-4 years ago, 5 years ago maybe now. What they did is they programmed up the machine learning algorithm that they had that found tinnitus versus normal. And they turned that loose on the data set. And it basically ended up identifying the same problem with different locations, different networks. So it's a foundational failure mode in the brain. And depending upon where it is, you have a different symptom. Luckily, the fix is fairly straightforward. Replace the input. Well, I lost my hearing. Now I'm having tinnitus. Well, for God's sakes, get a freaking hearing aid. Replace the input if you can. Now, not every input can be replaced. You can end up having a nerve problem that won't, no matter what your ear is hearing, it won't put something through. But if you can, replace the input. If you can't, I mean, you lost your limb, you're not going to replace the input from a limb that's lost. But you can put an implant in the brain that stimulates the area. So instead of having input from the brain to the cortex, you input on the cortex with an implant. And those are the implants that Dirk would put in to turn off tinnitus. Now, you know, when you put an implant in the brain, you're going to stimulate something depending upon where you put it. And, you know, the auditory cortex on the right side sits close to some interesting other areas. Your sense of self, your sense of self and others. The God spot. I mean, all these are over there in that temporoparietal junction. And Dirk put an implant in a fellow back in 2007. It was published in New England Journal of Medicine. When you put the implant in, and they turn on a couple of pairs to find out which pair of electrodes makes it work best to turn off his tinnitus. Well, when they turned on one pair, he reported an out-of-body experience. Oh, that's a little different, you know. So in the U.S.
Wait, hold on. Parkinson's, tinnitus, and out-of-body experience, they're all...
Well, the out-of-body experience was because the stimulator triggered the circuitry the sense of self, and he had an out-of-body experience. And New England Journal of Medicine, November 2007, something like the neuroimaging of out-of-body experience, something such as that for the title. And basically, in the U.S., they would have cut the leads to those wires so you couldn't stimulate them anymore. told the guy it was just a drug effect from sedatives during the surgery, and they swept it under the risk management rug, and nobody would have known the difference. But Dirk isn't like your normal guy. He's a curious fellow, and he has his own lab, and you know, he basically said, well, he can't tell if the stimulator is on or off by feeling it. He can only tell us if he's in or out. So we have a blinded radar out-of-body experience study to do here. Stick him in the fMRI. And, you know, in versus out, you can end up plotting the difference, you know, like fMRI stuff does. And let's look for where this out-of-body experience stuff is. And, you know, that's a really interesting piece of science. And New England Journal of Medicine isn't really into publishing about out-of-body experience. This is not their hot topic. They're like medical topics, but this is a medical topic with a bizarre, you know, twist to it. He sent that article in twice to the New England Journal of Medicine, and they sent it back. Now, a big journal, if they're not going to accept, they just send your manuscript back. No comment. They just send it back. And, you know, he got it back twice with no comment. And I was in Europe at a meeting, I think somewhere 2005, 2006. And I think it was in Berlin, 2005, actually. And he showed me his paper, and because I had done a talk on consciousness, and this guy's obviously, you know, out-of-body experiences, an odd consciousness thing, you know. So he asked me to look at his paper, and he asked me what's wrong with his paper. And I'd read it, and I said, well, there's nothing wrong with the paper. It's fabulous science. He said, well, New England Journal of Medicine sent this back twice with no comment, so there's got to be something wrong with it. I said, whoa, New England Journal of Medicine. You know, your writing is in European syntax. I can read this. I can tell this is a European author. And if you don't have a Boston accent, you probably don't get into the New England Journal of Medicine. So let's rewrite this with the East Coast syntax and see whether it's just that. So he handed it to me in an electronic file format instead of on paper. I rewrote it that night and handed it back to him on a thumb drive. He submitted that, and it was accepted November 2007. And yeah, it takes time to actually get something published from the time it's submitted, but it went through the process and ended up being a November 2007 publication. Now, he does thank me in the last paragraph for reviewing a prior version of the manuscript. So my name as a not an author in any sort of a way is in that paper, but it's published. And, you know, it's nice to know that somebody with an implant to turn off tinnitus ended up accepting the additional research to actually show what the out-of-body experience was like and what areas in the brain were actually involved in it. So,
now, Jay, we did a show on out-of-body experience with some screen shares. I'm going to put a link to that in the notes. But just briefly, to wet people's whistle, to get them to go and click on this link, what is going on? Is it in the temporal region? Like, what's happening?
Yeah. And in fact, the stimulation isn't just the spot you stimulate. It's a network in the brain that you stimulate. And Dirk shows some of the hot spots within that network. Okay. But the temporal parietal junction is the surface access point to tap into that network. And again, that location ends up having the sense of self, the sense of self versus others, and the God spot all sitting right around the same spot. So you're stimulating an interesting location in the brain that's networked up with some other interesting locations. And it's it'd be good to have an N of 5 or 10 or 25 of people that had the same thing, but it wasn't a common finding. Dirk's been implanting stimulators in the temporal lobe for people for tinnitus for a long time. He invented that surgery.
So when somebody's having this experience, it's usually they've had an accident and, they're about to pass. Why is that network getting activated when, that trauma occurs?
Oh, well, as you're passing, there's all sorts of metabolic changes that end up happening in the brain. The near-death experience is kind of an interesting trip. I actually don't even try to avoid it, or I don't get freaked out about it or anything anymore at all. It's kind of like being invited into the carnival ride. It's an interesting trip, and after having done it a number of times, it's not like a fearful trip. It's just, go again. Ride it out and see how it is, and if the Grim Reaper shows up, I wave, I'm over here, so it's not a bad experience. And people who've had near-death experiences have a different relationship with passing. It takes a lot of the angst out of what that whole experience is going to be.
Is it an oxygen thing, or what's pushing the button?
Mine's probably odd metabolic. I mean, no pituitary. How goofy can your metabolic stuff get? Well,
yeah.
I'll tell you how goofy it can get. It can damn near kill you. And it can kill you. The average person with no pituitary at all, the life expectancy is 10 years. For women, it's actually shorter. The reason that it averages 10 is that women, it's not as good, and men it's a little better. Now, I've been 30 years, so I'm way past the estimate.
Right.
Yeah. And the surgical patch failed a few years ago. So now I leak cerebrospinal fluid out my nose, and I'm not well enough to have a shunt and a patch and everything.
Right.
So I'm just a leaker now, So
metabolism.
I'm sure there's dramatic metabolic changes. There are people that have it following a trauma, but trauma can put you into a coma pretty easily as well. The ability to actually recover from coma exists in life. I think we actually did a little series on that.
Yeah, we did.
And
we'll put that here.
We were relatively effective at waking people up out of a coma, but they weren't all happy to come back. So I just don't do that stuff anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't spent time in coma, but my near-death experiences weren't in normal waking consciousness. So, they're often enough still, unfortunately. At first, they were a lot more often before I learned how to kind of manage all the chaos of pharma that have to be juggled. If you're juggling 6 or 7 balls and you drop one, it's you have to keep juggling, but you got to figure out which one you dropped so that you can fix that, or it might be the thing that takes you out. And you have to make the right guess. And occasionally I would make the wrong guess, and that would damn near kill me. And, when you make the wrong guess, you'll notice the error at some point. And if you're response to that is proper, you might pull yourself back out. And luckily I've had the right guesses, but things fall apart, and
that's right,
you can't make it forever. I'm fine with whatever the process goes,
just some mental duct tape.
Duct tape and bailing wire,
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Jay Gunkelman, thank you. This the NeuroNoodle podcast, like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. You start with Parkinson's, then you go to tinnitus, and then out of body experiences. What a show!
Yeah. You know, Elon Musk's Neuralink was mentioned, and Dirk has an interview online where he's talking about the future of implants and the fact that they're going to have AI in the implant chip at some point. Now, he's consulted by the people who make chips that go for implants on what the next design step needs to be. So you can bet that what he's talking about is going to be in the next series. But he wants the chip to actually learn and adapt so that the stimulation can end up being optimized by the chip itself. Now, Elon Musk wants to also not just measure your brain activity, but influence it. It's not just an electronic stethoscope to listen to the brain function. He's got his fingers in there pushing buttons. So he's going to do stimulation to manipulate the brain function as well as measure the brain function. And his invention for threads that are going to be inserted, subdural threads, end up being an interesting approach. There are other people that are basically trying to have little kind of nanobots that are amplifiers that can be fired up with ultrasound will power them up. And at that point, they will measure. And you basically inject them and then find out where they are and kind of live with where they are as the spot that they're measuring. So there's different ways to get stuff in there, but you got to be subdural in order to end up having the resolution that you really need for a real true brain computer interface and computer brain interface. So it's not just one direction. The AI stuff should be able to optimize the function of implants. But, you know, Dirk did a nice talk here in the Napa Valley a couple years ago for Cynthia Kirsten's little group lecture. And he presented on the topic that, you know, I asked the question and he presented the topic. He had to leave, but just before he left, he dropped this, you know, cognitive bomb on the audience. And it starts out discussing the ability to implant memories. If you record a memory on one person, you can implant or play it back in another person. Now that sounds like freaking Total Recall, you know, plunk in the memory of that's not yours, but it feels like yours because you're having the memory.
Could have used that at finals time.
Yeah, and then as he started to talk about all the AI and stimulation and all of that, it started to look a little bit more like Skynet, you know. there were people that were actually they were triggered to a certain extent by the idea of somebody controlling their brain, which is not a new idea. Jose Delgado, a neurosurgeon, many years ago, put implants in the brains of bulls. And he would step into the bullfighting ring with a little box with a button on it. And they'd have this bull all enraged. You know, the picadors stick stuff in them, and they're all blowing snot out their nose and pawing the ground. And so he steps into the ring. You know, he doesn't have all the shiny metal things on him. He doesn't have a cape waving to try to distract the bull or anything. He's got a box with a button on it. And the bull looks around and he sees, there's a freaking idiot in the bull ring. I'm going to go get him, you know. And he's paws the ground and he starts to charge towards him. He hits the button. Comes to an immediate stop and goes, what the hell was that? And then he looks around and says, "That stupid guy's still here." And he starts to go again. He two, three, four, you know, hits to the button. This bull is not going to go anywhere near him. Yeah. It literally stopped his behavior. He wrote a book called Control of the Human Brain. And, you know, I used to actually go to the library to see who might have checked it out. You know, because, you know, you want to kind of know who in your area is thinking about, you know, physical control of somebody else's brain. But, you know, that's what medical implants basically are doing, usually to good effect with proper motivation. About the same time, the book Terminal Man came out, and the book Terminal Man, temporal lobe epileptic who has violent, outrageous behaviors, and they put on an implant to kind of stop that. But eventually, he kind of works his way around the implant. You know, you mm-hmm. It's an interesting twist on free will. You know, do we have free will? You know. Are our behaviors totally predicted? Were the Calvinists correct? This is all predetermined. I don't know that it's all predetermined. You know, I sort of feel like I have free will. I can make a choice. One way or the other, and I can change my mind and make a different choice. It seems like I have free will. There are those that will say, well, all the programming and what happened to you previously is determining in a way what you're going to be doing. And, you know, I will argue with them and they'll say, well, it was predetermined that you would be arguing with me.
That doesn't sound like a fun dinner party.
Well, you know, it's talk. There's nothing wrong with talking theoretically about a whole bunch of things. But at some point, you get to the logical extreme of an argument, and it's just it's to the logical, illogical extreme.
Yeah.
You know, you take something to the point of it being ridiculous. And I think total determinism or total freedom are both probably a bit wrong.
Jay Gunkelman, thank you for this show, my friend.
Well, have fun with it. I don't envy the editing of anybody who's doing an interview with me.
Any show we can do with you, Jay, is fantastic. The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and viewers just like you. A special thanks to our gold and silver supporters. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop December 10th and 11th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend: online or in person with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. And if you sign up now, you can join Dr. Robert Thatcher at his house for a pre-course get-together December 9th. It's going to be a blast. What a better way to enjoy winter by being in Madeira Beach, Florida, and earning up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. MindMedia.com. Get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from MindMedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit MindMedia.com now.